Hello, and welcome to a very special bonus episode of the Reason Roundtable. And I mean that very much in the after-school special sense. There will be a cheesy moral at the end. I'm Peter Suderman, and tonight I am joined by my colleagues Catherine Mangu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Robbie Suave. Everyone say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
We are taping live on Saturday night from Pasadena, California, in front of a select group of Reason superfans and supporters, but I repeat myself. So if you are listening at home right now, you may hear the clinking of glasses or the cheering or jeering of the crowd. And in fact, I want to test this fully operational live show battle station right now. Reason Weekend Pasadena attendees, say hello to the listeners of the Reason Roundtable. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Great crowd, everyone. So, happy Saturday. Listeners at home, like I said, are not going to hear this for several more days. And because of that time lag, we are going to tackle some topics that are a little bit removed from the minute-to-minute Twitterized churn of the cable news cycle. And the first on that list is inflation. Because I am hosting, we're going to do segment titles. And I'm going to call this segment, Why is Everything So Expensive?
No.
You may recall around this time last year when President Joe Biden said that fighting inflation would be his number one economic policy priority. And yet, in the months after Biden made that promise, inflation shot up to 9.1%, hitting a 40-year high last summer. The cost of seemingly everything, rent, gasoline, cars, food generally, and especially meat and eggs, grocery store staples, went up and up and up. And while inflation has moderated somewhat since then, it remains quite elevated. Just a few days ago, the Consumer Price Index reported that year-over-year inflation was still 6%. Last August, Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act, which approved about $740 billion in federal spending. That law was intended to combat climate change through subsidies, lower healthcare costs, again, through subsidies. And then also, I guess, somehow we're supposed to understand it was supposed to reduce inflation because, you know, you're just going to have to trust them on this one. It's right there in the name. It reduces inflation and there are subsidies. So inflation is complex. There's always many causes. But it's worth dwelling briefly, I think, on the simple Econ 101 definition here. Too much money chasing too few goods. And so I'm going to say that again. Just for the slow listeners who here, right? Just to
we're right here.
That's for Nick, right? Too much money chasing too few goods. And what Biden delivered after his promise to tame inflation sounds an awful lot to me like too much money. But maybe that's not what Biden was talking about. Let's be generous. Let's try to see his side here. After all, Joe Biden is also the commander in chief, and he did order the military to start shooting down hot air balloons. So if shooting down balloons isn't a war on inflation, I don't know what is. Catherine, I want to start with you here. Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act into law in August of last year. Why is inflation still so high?
You know, Peter, I wish that I could answer that, but the math is so hard. Let's review once again. So we put a whole bunch of money, and it seems to be chasing, would you say it's the right number of goods, Peter?
It's some number.
It's some number of goods. So the St. Louis Fed did a report. It came out in February, and they just said it's too much money chasing too few goods. Again, but with like so many words. And I think it must be really hard to be the St. Louis Fed because there's like only so many times you can just say that same thing. But apparently they have to keep doing it because it's not working. Spending more money doesn't work.
There's not that much going on in St. Louis.
So, that's true.
St.
Louis is a really exciting town. They have great ribs. So Nick, I want to go to you here. Do you think there were, you know, some policy choices made during the pandemic, perhaps even before Biden became president? Perhaps about $4 trillion worth before he became president, and then another $2 trillion right after he became president. About $6 trillion worth of policy choices that may have contributed to escalating prices.
Yeah, absolutely. And in 2019, the federal budget was $4.4 trillion. By 2021, it was $6.8 trillion. So that's a 50% increase in 2 years. Biden also, and this kind of got overshadowed in the news that Trump is going to arrest himself. He's going to proclaim a citizen's arrest on himself sometime.
Wait, we don't know when this is being released.
Yeah, but
he
it
might already
matter.
Be in prison yeah, by the time he, this is heard.
We are did all it, we're like time travelers' wives up here. Yeah. We can't do this.
He did it on Truth, so nobody knows.
This is like when the bad guys in Superman were banished to the negative zone or the whatever the zone was, right, where they're outside of time. It's very much like that.
In any case, Biden in the past week or recently released a $6.8 trillion budget proposal, which isn't going to be passed because Congress will do that, but it'll be kind of close to that. But you not only have like a massive sustained increase, a series of $6 trillion budgets for the federal government, but the promise of even more. And I think that's a big part of keeping inflation high, even if the supply of goods is going to start to increase. You know, egg prices are starting to come down and all of that, which is good. But if the government is saying we're going to keep spending more and more money each and every year, it's going to be hard for inflation to disappear anytime soon.
Robbie, let's go to you. When Biden came into office, he immediately set about passing a $2 trillion spending bill, right? So this was on top of the $4 trillion that had already been passed the previous year. And that was the American Rescue Plan. And this was stuffed with longstanding Democratic policy priorities. It was billed as pandemic relief, but almost none of the spending was actually related to the pandemic. And it was radically oversized, right? So to the point where even economists long associated with the Democratic Party, folks like Larry Summers, were warning in quite strong terms that this would cause runaway inflation. I want you to help me understand the politics of this. Like, what were they thinking? Coming out of the first year of the pandemic, why were Democrats in Congress and the Biden administration just so eager and determined to rush forward with a giant spending package, despite warnings that it would cause runaway inflation that were coming from inside the House?
Wait, are you telling me that trillions of dollars in new spending do not reduce inflation? Wow. Why did we do that then?
I really feel like we've learned a lot this here
is the
tonight.
Question here. But
it's wild.
This is the thing that I, in some ways, struggle to understand is they understood that inflation would be a political problem if it happened. And yet, they went ahead and passed a bill that their economists were saying would cause inflation.
Well, I mean, you have to think about I think what the motivations are for the political figures, which is not necessarily to have the healthiest economic climate overall for like all voters and all people and all businesses, but to reward constituent interest groups, which that was a lot of the COVID spending, right? A lot of all that stuff. I think of all the education money spent, right? We're going to give schools all this money. They're going to use this ostensibly to make their schools safer from the spread of COVID, and because we would like to get the kids back into the schools, actually. Well, some of us would have liked to do that. A lot of the people in the education sector actually didn't, it turned out. Now, did they use this money to, like, have better air filtration and all that stuff? I looked through the grant proposals, and some of them are like, yeah, we're going to rebuild our gym. Okay, how's that going to stop COVID from spreading? It's not going to have anything to do with inflation, but that, you know, they're rewarding teachers, groups, educators, all that kind of thing. I think that speaks for a lot of the COVID, or just all of this money being spent. They're rewarding specific groups, not trying to make the economy better.
And they were also rewarding individual households, making, you know, in the last bill, and I think I'm pulling this from something you wrote, the last round of direct payments went to households making up to $160,000. So, I mean, they're buying votes, right? That's
you also
part
had
the
child tax credit that was built into there, which was a one-year program to send checks basically to pretty much every household. There was an income cap on it, but I think it was something like $400,000 a year. So pretty much every household with kids in the country.
I mean, what was student loan debt forgiveness but a bribe to a certain electorate constituent?
And not part of that plan, but again, along the same lines. And I think this sort of goes.
Well, I was going to say because you were asking about the politics and Biden. He plays it on TV. He may not seem to be very convincing, but he is the president. And by all accounts, he was haunted by the fact that the Obama stimulus was too small, which is kind of hard to fathom now. And, you know, this is a truism about America that we forget our history as soon as we make it. But, you know, that the Obama stimulus was terrible and useless and overwrought. But the message that Biden and I think his closest people were that it was too small. So this was the time to go big because it didn't work the last time.
I also think inflation is always a problem for tomorrow Biden. You know, today Biden really enjoyed handing out a lot of money. And like, tomorrow Biden can deal with inflation if it happens. And I think you can never underestimate the power of just like shoveling problems onto tomorrow's politicians, even if they're going to be you.
In February of 2021, Biden tweeted out, "Let me be clear. The risk in this moment isn't that we do too much. It's that we don't do enough. Congress must pass the American Rescue Plan to change the course of this pandemic and start our economic recovery." This was his message to Congress, was you have to go big, and that there was no risk in overdoing it. Catherine,
he's the Oscar Schindler of inflation.
I'm not going to touch that
one. I could do so much more.
We're just going to move on. I'm going to go back to Catherine and ask Catherine. They felt like they were learning lessons from the previous recession. That the lesson there was the $900 billion stimulus passed under Obama wasn't nearly big enough. That was the lesson they thought they had learned. Do you think they have learned any lessons from this round of spending and from the inflation that it caused? Are we learning anything, Catherine?
You know, we had some great speakers this weekend, including Chris Best, who did use the word learnings, which is not one of my personal favorites. Were there learnings is what we would say if we were in Silicon Valley, I think, who are really having some learnings right now. I mean, the wrong lessons are always going to be learned. We're always going to be fighting the last war. And, you know, my recollection of the way the conversation went at the time wasn't even, last time we didn't go big enough, so we should go bigger this time. It was, the bigger the number you are advocating for, the more you show that you are taking this problem seriously. And that's actually a little bit of a different thing. This like desperate desire to be seen as caring, you know, message I care, but just in dollar signs, was how the whole conversation went. There was almost nothing about how it would work, the mechanism of it.
So, Nick, The result of inflation is that the Fed has tried to manage it via interest rates. It's hiked them every couple of months or so for the last year. But it turns out that interest rate hikes have other downstream consequences. For example, they played a role, probably a significant role, in the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, leading to the Biden administration implementing a bailout.
So what's the problem?
Right. I mean, right. Like, so this is bad policy.
Why are we talking about inflation? We could be talking
about
that. Yeah.
But this is, I guess, I wonder if you see this as in some sense, kind of an internal contradiction here. It seems like if you are trying to slow down a hot economy, wouldn't some bank failures, I don't know, do the trick? Like, isn't in some ways the point of raising those interest rates to make the economy work less well? And that's what happened at Silicon Valley Bank.
Well, recessions are pretty good at squeezing inflation down, right? But for me, the most interesting thing was the speed with which Biden announced that, don't worry, we're going to cover all the deposits. We're going to cover everybody. We're going to make everybody whole. I mean, they didn't even wait a beat. And that's worrisome. I think that we are kind of entering a moment where money is no longer a constraint in government. The way that people think, the way that they act. And this is really kind of new territory. We've talked, I mean, literally at Reason for the entire 21st century about the idea that the government is on a bender, you know, a cocaine bender. And the one thing you want to do when you realize you've done too much cocaine is to keep doing cocaine, because it's really going to suck when you come down. And then you put stuff on the credit card. And I think that's where we are now. But what had been perhaps a mistake that could have been rectified under Bush, slowed down a little bit under Obama, ramped up again under Trump, and now under Biden. It's just, you know, we're living in a world now where the people who run the federal government no longer worry about enough money, because it'll always be there, they think.
So this nicely tees up my next topic here. The Inflation Reduction Act wasn't the only big ticket legislation that President Biden signed last year. There was also another bill intended to subsidize the production of semiconductors or computer chips to the tune of about $280 billion. The bill in question was called the Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors Act. And so for those who love acronyms, that's CHIPS. Sadly, the CHIPS Act has absolutely nothing to do with Doritos or that 1970s cop show starring Eric Estrada. And we are going to call this segment Chips Ahoy. Yeah, we're just doing it, folks. Biden has argued that the CHIPS Act is going to produce a number of benefits. He says it's going to reduce inflation since, you know, semiconductor shortages drove up prices for cars, computers, video game consoles, so on. He says it's going to protect national security since the bill is designed to subsidize domestic production of a vital good, computer chips, right? Everybody needs those, meaning that in theory, Americans won't be as reliant on semiconductors produced in China. Perhaps most prominently, however, Biden has pitched the CHIPS Act as a way of creating domestic manufacturing jobs. So these aren't the only manufacturing subsidies that Biden has championed either. The Inflation Reduction Act, to go back to that, also contains a bunch of subsidies for electric vehicle production, other forms of green energy, a bunch of factories, a bunch of factory jobs is what Biden's claim is here. And all of this is part of what the Biden administration has explicitly described as a form of industrial policy. That is their phrase, not mine. It's also my phrase. But it's theirs too. And Biden has spent the last year touring the country, appearing at factory sites, touting the creation of new manufacturing jobs, some of which have definitely not yet been created, and then taking credit for these jobs that are going to be created, hypothetically, and saying, this is a quote, he says this over and over again, they are a direct result of my economic plan. So, Catherine, how does that make you feel when a president shows up at a factory and says, this is all because of my economic plan? That's great, right? He's got a plan for the economy.
Why you gotta ask the lady the feelings question, Peter?
Yeah. Wow. I asked you the question about the jobs, the hard hat jobs, the factories. That's what we're doing here.
I, like you, am furious on behalf of actual chips, which are delicious and cheap. And the CHIPS Act is the exact opposite. So chips are being slandered here. Yeah, I mean, this is a bipartisan activity, right? Presidents love to stand in front of a partially built factory and say, I manifested this. Like, I brought this thing into being with my sheer force of will. I recommend to you, if you have not consumed it, either in video or article form, Eric Bames reporting on a semiconductor factory that is being planned in upstate New York, which people are being bullied off of their property. It's just a Foxconn 2.0. It's really a mess up there. I do want to note, Eric very consistently seems to find stories where one of the main characters is a guy who owns like a craft brewing company. And I was rereading the story in anticipation of this podcast, and the pattern came together, and it was like this, you know, bulletin board of pictures and yarn, and I was like, I'm seeing it now. So
reporters have mysterious ways, right?
I think Eric might just be going out for beers instead of reporting these stories, but.
So he's doing reporting.
Yeah, he's doing reporting.
It's called being a journalist.
But this story keeps happening over and over, that it's, you know, it's the photo op, it's the $1 billion out the door, and then in the end, the jobs don't actually appear, and meanwhile, you know, property has been taken, lives have been ruined. It doesn't work, and it's weird to me, actually, that presidents keep getting away with the photo op.
Yeah, so since you bring up Foxconn, let's go over some of those details real quick here. When Donald Trump was president, he went to Wisconsin to tout the 13,000 factory jobs that were going to be created at the Foxconn plant. This was a Chinese factory that was going to be built to make high-end LCD panels. The plant was going to get about $1.5 billion in subsidies and other inducements from the local government and the state. And Trump called this facility, which had not yet been built and there had not really created any jobs at that point, he called this facility the eighth wonder of the world. Today, like 6 years later, the facility still has not been built. They obviously do not produce any LCD panels there. And Foxconn has downgraded their long-term jobs estimate to something more like 1,400 jobs. Meanwhile, the town that was supposed to host the plant is incredibly in debt from all of the subsidies that they doled out, and dozens of homes were bulldozed to make way for this plant, some of which were seized via eminent domain. So, Nick, I've bashed Biden here, but this does seem like a bipartisan tendency. It also seems, though, like Biden is operationalizing this sort of industrial policy on a much larger scale. Am I wrong, or is there just a straight line between Trump and Biden here?
You know, I think, you know, we're all working off the assumption that Biden knows where he is. So he might be, he might think he's running for re-election as senator from Delaware in like in the early 70s or in the mid 70s. I do think Trump, you know, this is in many ways, I mean, there are multiple parts of the Biden administration, of the Biden policy, where they are essentially kind of following what Trump was doing, but doing it less weirdly or more in a more traditional way. And I think, you know, maybe that's what
more
Biden
traditional as
here.
In more expensive.
Yeah. Well, and like more professionally, I guess, you know,
yes, also that, yeah. I mean, it's more expensive in part because it is more focused and he right. can rally the votes for something in Congress and he can take the time to actually get Democrats. And in this case, the CHIPS bill, I should say, there were Republican votes for that. That was not sure. a strictly partisan piece of legislation.
This is, you know, not to pull the topic off of the Democrats or Joe Biden pushing huge spending and things like that, but this is also, it reflects the collapse of the Republican Party as a serious counterweight policy-wise. Because, you know, when Biden came out with his $6.8 trillion proposal, you know, Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, talked about how we're going to have a proposal and we're going to show how he's spending way too much, But the main message was $6 to $8 trillion is too much, but they're not spending enough on defense, even though defense spending in Biden's proposal went up like 3.3% or 4%. You know, this is what happens where the parties are just going to bid each other up in offering a kind of utopian fantasy land.
And in fact, some of the kind of nationalist conservatives who you may have heard Stephanie Slade talk about or write about recently have been saying, well, what we need is industrial policy. What we need is for the federal government to subsidize and make possible factory jobs so that it basically for because they believe that this is going to be pro-family formation. And so it's, the Republican Party isn't just sort of voting for the CHIPS Act. You have the intellectual policy infrastructure of the Republican Party saying that this is a good thing. And Biden is doing it in some ways more than Trump is. Although there's also some strings attached that I think are interesting and we should talk about. And Robbie, this is one of the things I want to ask you about. So as the money for the CHIPS Act has rolled out and come online, we have seen that that money is going to come with requirements. So companies that take that money are going to be required to pay prevailing wages and they're going to be incentivized to use union labor. They're also going to be required to provide on-site childcare. And notice I'm giving this question to Robbie, Catherine. They're going to be required to provide childcare. And so I guess, once again, I'm going to ask, isn't there a kind of a contradiction here? Isn't this sort of weird? Right? This is going to make it harder for manufacturers to comply. It's going to raise costs.
You know, before we get to that, Catherine, why didn't Reason have on... site childcare when you, well, you have kids. I had kids. I mean, I don't know, you know, this.
We've done something wrong, Nick.
We're working for the wrong operation.
Industrial policy, but make it reason.
You could have just brought them into the office.
Yeah. You know, they didn't like it any more than the rest of us.
All right. So, Robbie, this my question here is this a social policy bill that uses semiconductors at, like just as a pretext to do other stuff, or is it actually an industrial policy bill designed to give us American semiconductors?
It's all of those things. It's a Frankenstein monster, which is all policy now is done. It's backdoor policy making. Nothing, because Congress doesn't do very much. Everything happens by executive order. This is how we're going to get ESG, right? It's going to be snuck into all sorts of subsidy packages and everything else. This is how the federal government is going to sneakily implement requirements for how you run your businesses or how you take care of your children or how you do anything they want. You know, I understand the goal, frankly, of having more manufacturing done in America at a time where we have some actual serious quarrels with the Chinese government and the things that they've done. Okay, fine. But you can ask business people, what do they need to in order to have more plants and bring more manufacturing back here? They need the government to get out of the way. They need an end to all of the environmental impact regulation before you can build anything. They need a more favorable labor policy. They need immigration. They need lots of things. Government doesn't not going to help them with any of that. No, best we can do for you is here's a bribe, and then this factory's never going to get built. That's how we do. It's obviously everyone understands it's dumb. The people actually involved in manufacturing understand it's dumb, but that's the best Biden and Trump and everyone else can do.
Can we give Robbie?
Oh, I got some applause.
Some claps, and also,
woo, Robbie.
Oh, I don't.
I was just going to give you credit for saying Frankenstein's monster. and not Frankenstein.
I know that I'm a literature major.
Good work.
Yeah. You know, one upside, though, might be if there is on-site child care, maybe we're going to start seeing 13-year-olds working again. Right?
Just like the Affordable Care Act. Okay, we're back to the 13-year-olds.
It's so, the family unit as the household
production. The on-site child care to assembly line pipeline. Is that what we're trying
to
set up?
Nick, I want to bring this back to last night in this room when we sung Happy Birthday to Adam Smith. One of Smith's most famous concepts, of course.
Don't tell people we're so nerdy, man.
Yes. For listeners in podcast land, in the room we are
taping this, a real scene, man.
There was a happy birthday song for Adam Smith, and it was wonderful. And one of Smith's most famous concepts, of course, was the invisible hand, right? And industrial policy seems to me like the exact opposite of that. It is the visible hand. It is central planning. It's not communism in a traditional sense, but I do wonder, like, do you feel like there is a relationship between Biden-style industrial policy and a Soviet-style planned economy? Yes, I'm not saying they are the same thing, but do you think they are in some sense on the same spectrum?
I actually don't think that's very helpful to put them on the same spectrum.
Fair enough.
You know, the economy is so big, and the control of this stuff, I think there is a difference between the type of economic policy or industrial policy that would have been trotted out in the 70s and now. None of this is to say anything good about what's going on now, but I don't think it stems from a belief or a need to control the economy. I think this is actually about buying votes, because the other thing that is interesting, and Biden won't stop bragging, and again, in his budget proposal, he talks about how unemployment at the time that he published it was at 3.4%. It was like a low for a 40 or 50 year period. So it's kind of bizarre that, you know, everybody is working, but we're going to bring more jobs back. Who's going to actually fill those jobs unless you're going to pay a lot more money, which is going to cause more inflation? Or are we actually going to let immigrants come here and work here? Things like that. I don't think this is, you know, creeping socialism. I think this is kind of vote buying desperation, and I worry that that is the mode of politics for the rest of our lives.
All right, so that gotta agree with a lot of that. So we're gonna switch gears here, and we're gonna talk about something that isn't related to the broader American economy: children's books. Specifically, we're going to talk about weird children's fantasy novels by the author Roald Dahl, which were recently subject to edits by sensitivity readers. There were words removed, phrases changed, in some cases whole sentences added, to make Dahl's work supposedly less offensive. Obviously, I'm going to call this segment "The Horse You Rolled In On." Dahl, of course, is the famous author of books like Matilda, James and the Giant Peach. He died decades ago, and his works are now owned by the Roald Dahl Publishing Group, which in 2021 announced they would proceed with a number of adaptations on Netflix. This year, Dahl's publisher, Puffin Books, worked with an outside consultant, a group called Inclusive Minds, to make changes to the text of his book. The edited versions removed words like fat, ugly, and crazy. In other cases, small details were changed. In The Witches, for example, women characters became top scientists and business owners. Previously, they had been cashiers in a supermarket. The edits made gender-specific terms gender-neutral. They omitted references to mothers and fathers, and in general, focused on descriptions related to weight, gender, race, and ethnicity. Robbie, I know you have written and thought an awful lot about these issues. This is just the latest example of so-called sensitivity readers being brought in to edit works intended for young readers. Give us some background here. Just ground us in what's going on. How pervasive is this? How does it play out behind the scenes? Does it worry you?
It worries me greatly, and it also worried Roald Dahl himself. I want to read to you a quote from him. He said this: "I've warned my publishers that if they later on so much as change a single comma in one of my books, they will never see another word from me, never, ever. And he said, when I am gone, if that happens, then I'll wish mighty Thor knocks very hard on their heads with his Mjolnir." That's the hammer, if you've seen the Marvel movies. I've seen them all.
I assume this statement was made before the Marvel movies.
Or he says, "I will send along the enormous crocodile to gobble them up." This is the fate Roald Dahl thought should await the censors of his material.
So how would the sensitivity readers rewrite that?
can we say enormous? Because we can't say fat, so maybe we can't say enormous. A hefty crocodile, a crocodile of size. How about that? So this problem with the sensitivity readers really is quite pernicious. So many new writers, young writers, are subjected to this ridiculous group of people who purport to have expertise pertaining to identity, race, gender, sexuality, etc. But oftentimes they have no expertise whatsoever. They just happen to fit that category. Kat Rosenfeld is a wonderful writer. She's a writer of young adult fiction. She also writes for Reason on occasion, and she had a great piece for us on this, describing the plight of this young author who is writing a book about an African-American man who had been formerly incarcerated or prosecuted, just fiction book, trying to make it at a university. And the author was assumed to be black, but it turned out he was Filipino. So the publisher at the last minute was like, wait, you're not black? Okay, we have to have someone who's black read this book then. And they got like a lady who was British, who was black, but like she has no understanding of an incarcerated young African-American adult. It makes no sense to have her weighing in on this. And this is what awaits so many authors now, is having these people who for totally surface reasons supposedly should be able to weigh in on this. Lionel Shriver, another author who has written for Reason, Catherine, you did a great interview with her a while back, author of the book What to Do, We Need to Talk About Kevin? That was what it's called. She has written so persuasively, I think, about why this is a bad thing for free expression, for intellectual diversity, forcing authors to only narrowly write about their own experience. I mean, that's an attack on the very idea of writing and journalism and all of it. You're supposed to persuasively write about other people's experiences, with some knowledge, of course. If you do a bad job of it, you should be criticized. But that should be up to the authors, not these sensitivity readers.
Even more than that, I think it's an attack on empathy. It's an attack on the idea that you can that someone can understand an experience that is not their own. My favorite story about sensitivity readers was the guy who worked as a sensitivity reader for a publication, for a publishing house, and then he, of course, wrote his own young adult fiction novel, which got unpublished because of sensitivity readers who said, "No, you can't publish this." So, Nick, I want to ask you here. This is the thing where I sometimes struggle with this issue as a libertarian. We have seen authors like Salman Rushdie call the Roald Dahl edits censorship. We've seen a general outcry about this sort of editing, but this is a private company making changes to works where it owns the rights. I understand the argument. In some ways, like, I buy the argument that it is a kind of censorship. But also, isn't it just a byproduct of property rights being passed down over the years? I mean, sometimes the guy down the block is going to build an ugly addition on his house, and it's going to really make the neighborhood look terrible. Do you think this is fundamentally different?
I don't think we're supposed to say ugly anymore, Peter.
Yeah. I also want to, as I always do, because I'm a Roald Dahl hater from way back, I want to point out that he is a raging anti-Semite. And it's kind of fascinating that this latest turn of events has kind of taken the light off of that. But he, if Robbie was quoting from him, here's a quote that he said, there's a trait in the Jewish character that does provoke animosity. I mean, there's always a reason why anti-anything crops up anywhere. Even a stinker like Hitler didn't just pick on them for no reason. That came out in the 90s. I mean, it was Roald Dahl, by his own account, was a tremendously awful human being. And it doesn't change what's happening here, which is screwed up. And I think is not wrong, because you're right. This is his literary estate, in the same way that Dr. Seuss's literary estate can do whatever they want, including not publishing things. I think what is particularly disturbing about this is it's really memory-holing stuff. And Kat Rosenfeld, again, who Robbie mentioned, wrote a great essay for us about this. There are stealth edits. You know, we've written about the 1619 Project, where mistakes or changes get made without anybody knowing. This kind of thing happens. It happened, ironically, to Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451. The version of that book that most of us probably read if you grew up in the 70s was a bolderized edition that he didn't know that his publisher had changed words in it to make it more palatable for high school audiences.
Yeah, it was, and he flipped specifically out for school children.
Yeah, and he flipped out when he heard that, and he made Ballantyne, publish the actual book when he found out about it. And what's interesting here, and again, this isn't a direct contradiction of what we're talking about here. But when you, as we shift to electronic media, and Kat Rosenfeld has talked about this, you don't actually own the media in the same way. It's one thing if you downloaded a song or a file onto your computer, but if you're reading it through Kindle or through a variety of other things, you are licensing the right, or you're buying a license to read that through that. But Amazon owns it, and Amazon actually can completely vaporize your collection of works. They can change things and update texts with all sorts of things without telling you. And Kat Rosenfeld has talked, I think, very persuasively about this, that that may or may not be a good idea in any given circumstance, but the fact that we're not aware of it or thinking about it or noting it is troubling, because, you know, this, without going full Orwell or full Bradbury, you know, it's a good idea to understand the editing process, because we're constantly revising ourselves, the stories we tell about ourselves, the stories that we share with our children, et cetera.
And one of the issues here is that it's not just that books are being censored or edited after the fact. It's that authors are self-censoring. And there is a chilling effect here in which authors feel like they can't write about certain topics, they can't write in certain ways. Catherine, I actually want to ask you the mom question now.
Mm. We
did get there eventually. You have kids in the target age range for Roald Dahl books, right? So how do you think about this as a parent? Are sensitivity readers actually protecting kids from anything? Because I just recall sensitivity readers weren't a thing when I was a kid, but like censorious librarians and parents were. And there were various adult authority figures that tried to hide age-inappropriate material from me, stuff that I really should not have been reading. And I will tell you, it did not work at all.
So I actually think one of the best ways for kids to encounter troubling ideas is through the veil of fiction. I think that when you're, you know, when you're processing something new that is scary, I know I learned a lot of things that I wasn't quite ready to think about as real in the context of particularly the kind of fiction that Roald Dahl writes, like the ridiculous, the absurd. This isn't waiting for me under my bed, or is it? And that, I think that taking that away from kids is probably a mistake. But of course, taking things away from kids is really always just the thin end of the wedge for taking it away from adults, which I think, you can multiply that lesson over and over. I did want to just throw one thing in about, Robbie, as you were reading that quote from Dahl, it really struck me that it was the exact opposite of another great writer, Arthur Conan Doyle, whose works are coming out from copyright protection as we speak. This year was a big, another tranche of them came out. This is all in the end probably an intellectual property rights problem, by the way. If, you know, the various states and publishers don't hold these manuscripts in perpetuity, they can't do this, or at least it's harder for them to make that be the definitive edition. But Arthur Conan Doyle famously hated Sherlock Holmes, just was absolutely done with that character's garbage, and once said, when someone asked if they could write a play where Sherlock Holmes got married, wrote back immediately, marry him, kill him, do what you like with him. Just, you know, and I think that's important too. If the author says, take what I have produced and take it and make it your own and change it, that's a very different thing than if the author says, I will send a fat crocodile for you and we should listen.
You know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle might have been one of the first content creators to experience audience capture, right? Because he killed off Sherlock Holmes, not liking him.
Brought him back.
And then was forced to bring him back because of complaints from his readers.
He would have been a great Substack author. Catherine, no, I think this is a good point to end on here. I have come to think of fiction as a way of modeling human psychology and relationships. It's a way of sort of containing the human experience and making it visible from end to end, of kind of structuring disorderly lives and giving us a way to make sense of a messy, sprawling, difficult to kind of fully comprehend existence. And that, I think, is a good transition to our final segment, our cultural recommendations. Because this is a very special bonus episode, we are going to do something a little bit different here. So I'm going to ask each of you, what is the single most libertarian piece of pop culture that you know of that has come out in your lifetime? So it has to be after the date of your birth. So for Catherine and I, that starts around 1980 or 81. For Robbie, it's a little later. And for Nick, it's pretty much anything since the planet was primordial ooze.
That's right, yeah.
Since the first fish swim out of water and began to walk on land. So we're going to start with you, Nick. Most well, libertarian piece of pop culture.
You know, there's this cave painting that I've got to tell you about.
That was a great cow.
Yeah. I picked the Dallas Buyers Club, the 2013 movie by Jean-Marc Vallée, starring Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto, who both won Academy Awards for it. But the Dallas Buyers Club is about a guy who is diagnosed with AIDS. It takes place in the 80s, and he's given 30 days to live. And then he starts scrambling to find alternative cures, just figure out anything that he could do possibly to extend his life. And he ends up routing around all sorts of FDA and various government restrictions on, you know, bodily autonomy, on patients' rights and things like that. And it is a phenomenal movie that is extremely libertarian in many ways. One is that the government is kind of the villain in this because people who basically represent the FDA, there's some chatter that the main villain is a composite character who also includes Anthony Fauci, who was involved in, you know, kind of dealing with AIDS in the 80s and early 90s and things like that. But you route around the government, but it's also about human kind of ingenuity and passion. And it really foregrounds the idea that you own your body and that you should be allowed to experiment with your body. And, you know, and then it's made so much more powerful by the fact that everybody in this movie, essentially, although the patients are dealing with a death sentence. It's really powerful. It's incredible. You know, it was basically the peak of Matthew McConaughey, too. It seemed like we were in a Matthew McConaughey renaissance that would never end.
The McConaissance.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, he's not even in
use
the Magic
Urban
Mike.
Dictionary, man.
He's not even in the Magic Mike movies anymore. So,
and yet the Magic Mike movies are now about how zoning codes and historical preservation rules are actually kind of bad and prevent entrepreneurship. Catherine, what do you have for us?
I'm going to nominate the Terry Pratchett Discworld novels, all of which were written in our lifetime. Dozens and dozens of books, which are sort of a, you know, magical, quasi-medieval and Renaissance context in which every single book is ultimately about how it might be better to let people do what they want to do and they're going to try their best. And that sounds cheesy. And they are a little cheesy, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. These books are, the reason that I give them this prize is because millions of people have read them and, you know, nowhere does he use the word libertarian. They're absolutely not propaganda. They're not even really political, but taken together, they just paint a world in which government is sort of corrupt and messy, but mostly dumb and silly. And I think that that's probably going to be the best way that we can make our case in the end. Pratchett was a Prometheus Award winner, shout out. And I particularly recommend the book Going Postal, which is just as ridiculous as it sounds.
I hope that is about a private delivery service.
No spoilers, Nick.
Yeah, okay.
Drone delivery only. Robbie, what do you have for us?
All right, I'm going to recommend a book. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. It's called Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah. Read another book.
I'm a peak millennial. I'm right in like the middle of this age group for which Harry Potter is just the most important thing that has ever existed. I am part of that cohort, absolutely. But I'm rereading them, re-listening to them, actually on audio tapes right now. What?
It's just so millennial.
Yeah, I am a millennial. I know. But you know what? They're still great, goddammit. And they introduce a lot of really good libertarian ideas to young people. The government of the magical wizarding world, the Ministry of Magic, is a sinister and incompetent organization responsible for incredible evil in the worlds of the Harry Potter novels. It changes slightly from novel to novel, but their due process is horrible. They send people to a really awful prison where they're tortured by monsters forever with no trials whatsoever. They're not elected, the people in charge of this. They become overtaken by dark wizards all the time. They're oppositional to the main character, Harry Potter. They're trying to smear him. And also, not just the government of the wizarding world, but also the media is culpable. It's funny now because J.K. Rowling obviously is a foe of many in the mainstream media for the positions, the opinions she's articulated on gender-related issues. This is obviously before any of that happened, but she has the same contempt for the media. The Daily Prophet, the wizarding newspaper, is horrible propaganda and lies. And actually, Harry Potter and his friends come to appreciate the alternative newspaper run by their friend Luna Lovegood's father, the reason of the Harry Potter world, I think.
Yeah. Oh. Robbie, did you ever dress up as Draco Malfoy?
I am very much a Slytherin.
You should not comment on that, Robbie. It could have all been solved if just there was wizard school choice. So I am going to go with that great 1980s action comedy classic, Ghostbusters. It's fun. It's funny. It's about a bunch of goofball academics who turned into small businessmen. They're smart guys who developed some novel technologies to solve a common household problem. Some places are just haunted. And because they are small businessmen selling a novel service, they are attacked and eventually shut down by New York City's EPA commissioner. He accuses them of being scam artists and of endangering the environment. But of course, it turns out that the EPA bureaucrat, whose actions end up threatening the entire city, it's the EPA bureaucrats whose actions end up threatening the entire city, putting everyone at risk. And so in the end, the mayor, finally seeing the light, has to call the Ghostbusters in to save the day. It's a great movie about academia and entrepreneurship, about bureaucrats and business, about politics and blame. And it's also the rare movie to essentially come out and say, the regulators are wrong and the small business inventors are right. And we need more of that energy in the world. I promised you a sappy moral at the end, and there it is. So before I go, I want to give everyone here in this room and listening back out in podcast land a sneak preview. The reason Roundtable will be coming to you live in New York City on Tuesday, April 25th. There are more details coming soon, but look out for that. And with that, we will close out this show. If you like this show, if you like Reason Magazine, if you just like Reason the idea, remember that you can donate at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all for listening and supporting our work. I'm Peter Suderman, and this has been The Reason Roundtable.